Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hi-yo. Welcome to Kiwi's Birth Tales. My brother name is Ollie and I'm Die Boy. Thank you for listening from Mommy's podcast. See you later.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Kiwi Birth Tales. I am your host, Jordan. I am a mum of two boys. I've got Jai, who is almost four, and Ali, who has just turned two. I also have a business baby, Your Birth Project, and if you're pregnant or you know someone who is, then you need Your Birth Project in your life. It will help you to create your best birth. There are so many exciting things coming for Your Birth Project in 2024. But that means with all of these new exciting additions, there will be a price increase from 2024. So if you want to lock in the course at the price it is now, which is $89, make sure you go and check it out on the website. It has got everything you need in there that is going to help you to just prepare for your labor and birth, know what you have rights to do, make informed choices, prepare your birth environment, make sure your birth partner is ready for your birth. There are so many different things in the course that you need. So make sure you go and check that out. I have a wonderful new episode for you today with the lovely Sinead, and she takes us through a horrific pregnancy. I'll let her do the talking, but yeah, she had hyperemesis and it was just like a total disaster for her. And I just really made me feel I don't even have the right words. I just felt like so heartbroken for her that was her experience. And I know other people around the world experience that too. And it's just, awful. So she talks a lot about that. She also talks about her and her husband's journey to becoming pregnant. They needed some help through IVF to do that. And then we talk through her labor and birth, which was an elective cesarean. And she talks us through why she decided that. So there's a lot in here. In her postpartum period, she has suffered with some quite serious mental health concerns. So she's talks really openly about that. But if you're not ready to hear about intrusive thoughts and how that can impact us in our postpartum periods, then make sure that you just skip over that part of the episode. But if you are, I think we've all got a lot to learn from Sinead and from people who speak openly about mental health in their postpartum period. And I know myself, like I suffered with intrusive thoughts post the birth of both Jai and Ali. And it feels like you're just thinking, who the heck am I? So what Sinead shares is very real. It's very raw. So just a reminder, if you get to that part of the episode and it doesn't feel like the right fit for you today, then just skip over that part. But I know you're going to love the episode. Sinead is so funny. She makes me laugh throughout the whole entire episode, even though her circumstances were less than ideal. So I hope you love it. I'd love to hear from you. Hit me up on Instagram, Kiwi Birth Tales, or Your Birth Project, or you can find me on email, jordan@kiwibirthtales.com. Enjoy the episode and we will speak soon.
Hi, Sinead. Thanks so much for joining me on the Kiwi Birth Tales podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a highlight of my life.
I hope to really make it worth your while and still feel like that at the end, but we'll see how we go.
I'm going to love it. It's going to be so cathartic because I had the worst pregnancy, so I just love to talk about it.
Cool. Okay, well, we are going to talk all about it today, but before we get into it, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about you and who is in your family?
Cool. So my name is Sinead Corcoran-Dye. I am a writer / journalist / small time content creator on Instagram. I have a husband. His name is Stu. I have two stepsons. I have my 3-month old daughter, Vivi, who we're going to talk about today. And I did have a cat called Leo, but since we brought the baby home, he hates her and has decided to just leave home. And he's now having an affair with our neighbor.
Oh, Leo.
That's all right. We had a good run.
Yeah. Awesome. Cool. Amazing. And why don't you take us through the journey to pregnancy for you and Stu? So what did that look like? And yeah, talk us through your experience.
Yep, so me and Stu met at work in 2020, and we fell in love instantly and knew we wanted to get married and have a baby and all of that because he already had two sons from a previous relationship, but I really wanted a baby of my own as well as my stepson, who I love. And so he knew that was like a non-negotiable for me if we were going to be together. And because Stu has low motility sperm, he had to have IVF to have his two sons, which meant that we never used contraception, even from like day dot, because we were like the chance of getting pregnant naturally is so slim. And if we did happen to get pregnant naturally, like we were fully all into our relationship, fully committed, so we would have been stoked, you know?
Amazing. And so when you sort of started thinking about like your journey to becoming pregnant, did they feel like there was like a right time to start trying, or did you just, go with the flow and see what happens? What was your sort of thinking there, knowing that potentially you might have to go down the IVF route?
So we started really soon, and that's because my husband, I think he was 44 at the time. He's 48 now, and so obviously time was not on our side. Do you know what I mean? Like I, you know,
Yeah,
like men can
sure.
have kids when they're like 100, but obviously I was conscious of his age, and he, was a tired man already with two kids. And also, I lost my mum when I was quite young. And so that was always in the back of my mind that, like, I didn't want that for my child. Like, obviously, you can't predict what happens in life, but I sort of wanted her to have the best chance possible of having her dad for as long as possible. So, we started the process about 2 years ago. So I think we've been together about 2 years. And we only waited that long because it was really important for me that we were married before we had a baby, because I didn't really grow up with like a traditional family dynamic, and I really wanted that for my child. And so, that two four kids, white picket fence, mum and dad married kind of vibe. And so we first started the process, yeah, about 2 years ago, and we did the first phase of so we went to Fertility Associates to start the process, and that's when we found out that we didn't qualify for public funding, because I always thought that everyone qualified for 3 rounds of publicly funded IVF under the system. But they do it under a points scheme, and because Stu already had two kids, they counted them as my kids. So they were like, you don't qualify for free IVF, which I didn't know, and was such a like a shock, and I was so gutted about it because I was like, that's not fair. Like, obviously my stepchildren are my kids and I love them to bits, but I wanted a biological baby and I thought I should be entitled to that, you know? And so at the time my husband was like, look, even if we did qualify for publicly funded IVF, it's often like years long wait list, we would have gone private anyway. And I was like, I get that, but it's just the principle that hurts.
Yeah, I didn't actually know that. I didn't realize. I knew about the point system, but I didn't know that, how the sort of kids in your family would contribute to that.
Yeah, and obviously, you love your stepchildren to bit. I love all my children
Yeah,
the
of
same.
course.
But it was the fact that, like, I was like, this is so unfair that my husband and his former partner got, they would have been entitled to free IVF and I'm not. And that's so unfair. So there was, a lot of like hurt around that. And so then we were like, okay, well, whatever, we'll go private, which was a huge financial toll for us. Like, we had to put it on our mortgage. And I felt really guilty around the cost because I knew, like, my husband already had two kids. We were only having this baby because of me. And, the house that we owned, the mortgage, that was my husband's house. That was his money. Like, obviously, it's our money. We're married. But I felt bad because it was his money that he was having to spend on IVF to have a baby that I was sort of making him have. Like, obviously, he wanted a baby and he loves our daughter, but he wouldn't have had another child if it wasn't, if he hadn't met me and me wanting one. So yeah, so 2 years ago we started the process, and we did the first phase. So we decided to split it into two parts, and we were going to do the first phase, like the growing the eggs, the injections, and that's horrible stuff, and then making the embryos and freezing them. And we did that first phase because I wasn't working at the time because I was really mentally unwell. So we were sort of like, you know, it's terrible that I'm mentally unwell, but this might be a good time to do all of that stuff because we don't know, you know, the sort of emotional and physical toll that you know, hormonal process is going to take on me. And we wanted to do it in two parts because we wanted to make the embryos, freeze them, and then after we got married, like, I think like 6 months later, we were going to put one in.
Yeah.
So did all the injections and all of that stuff, which definitely took a physical and emotional toll on me. Like, I was really, I don't know if it was the hormones, but I was really nauseous from the injections. I was vomiting in the kitchen sink all day, which was like a sign of what was to come because I was later going to get the worst hyperemesis in the world. And the emotional toll as well, like, there was definitely a level of resentment towards my husband, which I hate, because it's not his fault, but I was like, this again is so unfair. I'm having to do all the heavy lifting, you know, with the injections and being sick and like the, you know, how the hormones, you know, fuck your mental health and stuff. And I'm, you know, I'm 30, I'm perfectly fertile. You're the one with the fertility problems, not me. And I'm having to do all this. And all you have to do is like wank into a cup. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is just, this is so unfair. And so I hated that I was resenting my husband because, of course, fertility issues aren't anybody's fault. But I did resent him.
Yeah. And how did you like those feelings? I think, are just so important to talk about because there's so many different people going through like their own version of fertility challenges and like feeling those types of feelings, whether they talk about it or not. And did you talk about it with your husband? Like, did you talk about how you were feeling and like how did you sort of work through those feelings at the time?
Oh, absolutely. Like, I am not one to bottle things up. Like, I talk, you know, as you'll find out, I talk too much of anything. So, yeah, I was constantly venting to him and I was like, this is unfair. Why do I have to do this? You're the one with shit sperm. And he knows that all he needs to say, all he's supposed to say is just like, I know, I'm sorry. You're right. Like, you are the victim and I'm so sorry. I wish I could do the injections. And so, yeah, so we talked it through, like, open comms all the time, which I think was good because otherwise, you know, you do bottle that up.
Yeah, for sure. And so talk us through the next stage. Like, you're obviously doing the injections and you talked about splitting into two parts. So what happened after that first part? Was it successful in what you were trying to do? And, yeah, what happened next?
Yeah, so... So that first part was all good apart from being sick. But then I had that thing like hyperstimulation or whatever where you grow too many eggs, which is amazing, of course. But it meant that I was in so much pain because you have to have the internal exams and the egg retrieval. And I had to be put to sleep for the egg retrieval because every time I did had the internal exams done, I was like crying with pain because everything was so swollen. And so that was awful. And also I had this weird reaction, which I wasn't expecting, where after they made the embryos and were driving from the clinic, I was crying because I was like, I've abandoned my children alone in this freezer. They're all on their own. And I just wasn't prepared for like weird emotional responses like that. And also because I was 30, I only had one friend who had been through IVF and I just didn't really know anyone else my age who had done it. So Annabelle was like my absolute rock through it. But apart from that, I did feel pretty isolated because I didn't really have anyone to talk to about the resentment towards Stu and all of that. So then the next phase, so after the wedding, we got married in October and the Fertility Associates, the clinic, was closing down for Christmas. So we were like, they said to us, you know, if you want to get in before Christmas, you have to come when you get your period after the wedding. And so we were like, okay. And so then I got my period literally like the day after we got home from the wedding, so 4 days after we were married. And so we were like, oh, okay, well, I guess let's, go put the first embryo in. And my husband, Stu, because he'd been through IVF, he was like, look, I just don't want you to get your hopes up because most of the time the first embryo doesn't work, like it won't take. But it means that the next time you put an embryo in, your body's like more primed for it, and the second one often works. So like, let's just do this first one as like a practice, and then when the clinic opens up again in January or whatever, we'll put the second one in, and that one will hopefully work. So this was just supposed to be practice, and I was like, okay, cool. It wasn't a practice. It worked. We got pregnant. And I was obviously over the moon, so happy, but also I was like, fuck you, Stu. Like, you told me it wasn't going to work. And we've had no honeymoon period. It's summer. I had all these plans to be like drinking in the sun with my friends. And instead, I was, sober and miserable on the couch. But then I felt guilty for feeling mad because, we were so lucky to have it work first time. So, anyway, but yeah, around during that process, they put the embryo in, and we were supposed to wait 10 days before doing the test to find out if we were pregnant. And they're like, don't do any home tests, just wait for us to do the blood test. And I was like, okay. And I lasted, I think, 9 days. And then on the 9th day, I remember I was in the car parked outside of my house crying my eyes out. And I called my friend Annabelle, who had been through IVF. And I was just like, I can't handle this anxiety and uncertainty, not knowing if it's going to work. Like, I've been fine up until now, but now I'm just losing it. And so I went and I got KFC and a pregnancy test, and I came home and I took it, and it said it was positive. But I knew that that didn't necessarily mean it was positive because we had to wait for the proper one from the clinic. But I was like, nah, that like I'm pregnant. And I remember I called Annabelle before calling my own husband to tell her. And that afternoon, I actually had a job interview lined up, and so I just found out I was pregnant. And I remember driving to the job interview, and they were like, "Tell us why you want the job." And I was like, "I don't know, like I don't really like." And I was just so unenthusiastic because I was like, "I don't even care, like I don't want this job. I've got a baby coming. Like I just didn't, you know what I mean? I didn't care about anything else." And so then the next day we did the blood test, and Fertility Associates called us, and they're like, you're pregnant. And we were so excited. But I remember I was, everyone usually waits 12 weeks before telling anybody, just in case it doesn't pan out. And I remember I said, because I'm an overshare on Instagram, I share everything, but I said to Stu, like, I'm not going to share my pregnancy online. I'm just going to like wait, like go offline for 9 months like Kylie Jenner, and then when the baby's born, I'll come out with this like dramatic beautiful video announcing my surprise baby. And that's because I have really bad health anxiety because my mum died of cancer, and so I'm always paranoid that like I'm gonna get sick or things aren't gonna work out for me. And I was like, the baby's not gonna make it. And if I shared it on Instagram and then I, had a miscarriage or whatever, I would feel so ashamed, which is just such like a ridiculous response because there's nothing shameful about, a miscarriage or anything like that. And if I had seen someone else share a pregnancy announcement and but then share that they had a miscarriage, I would not, you know what I mean? I would not be like, oh my God, how embarrassing. But you are so much harsher on yourself. And also, oh, that obviously changed because then I was just so excited, so I did announce it, and then I ended up writing a pregnancy column and sharing every single thing. But as well, what was hard was I am on quite hardcore medications for my mental health, like antipsychotic meds, antidepressants, anti-anxiety meds. And lots of those are definitely pregnancy safe, but the ones that I'm on aren't, like they're really hard out. And so I had to come off all my meds and have an unmedicated pregnancy, which was really difficult at times. Because as well as not being on my meds that I was usually on, I also had to stop vaping, I had to stop drinking, and those were all things that I had always relied on as ways of like relaxing, and I had never built up any toolkit of like how to, like I don't meditate, I don't do anything wholesome, and so I had no ways of like I didn't know any other ways of relaxing without like meds or substances, so that made my pregnancy really difficult at times, particularly because I ended up so sick and in such a dark place mentally and physically.
And let's we can sort of unpack that a little bit more because I know that you had hyperemesis, but before we talk more about your pregnancy, when you say that you came off, like you had to come off all of your medication, because I know there'll be people who listen to this who, potentially are on similar type of meds or take medication for different mental health reasons. Were there medications they could like switch you to that could like help, or you just had to go like cold turkey and see what happens?
Yeah, for sure. So I have a psychiatrist who I'm in the publicly funded system because my mental health issues are quite severe, and so I have regular access to my psychiatrist Giselle, and yeah, she's amazing. And so she, when we came up, you know, with the plan that I had to come off meds, she was like, "But if things get really bad, there are options." Like I'm not a doctor, so I don't know what they are. Probably like sertraline or citalopram. But she was like saying that what's weird about pregnancy is lots of mental illnesses go away when you're pregnant because your body knows that it has to protect this baby. And it's also the same with lots of autoimmune disorders and diseases. They often go away in pregnancy as well. So for the first two trimesters, I was actually fine without being on meds in terms of my underlying mental health problems, but yeah, because I did get really bad hyperemesis and end up quite depressed as a result, I probably should have gone back on meds sooner. And yeah, and reflecting on my pregnancy, I wish that my doctors and obstetrician and psychiatrist had sort of recognized how bad I was getting and how much I was deteriorating, even though I wasn't really aware of it. And sort of put me back on some pregnancy safe meds to sort of cushion the blow of when I had the baby. Because as I'll get into, yeah, I ended up with really severe postnatal depression, which I wonder would that have happened or would that have happened so badly had I been put on meds, you know?
That makes total sense. Okay, so let's talk pregnancy first. Did you go under the care of a midwife or an obstetrician? And how were you feeling? Like, once you knew you were pregnant, how did you tell Stu? And how were you feeling in your first trimester? Talk us through that.
So I told Stu, so I called Annabelle, told her, and then I called Stu and told him, and he was stoked, but he was like, "Let's just wait for the real results tomorrow." And then we found that out, and he was, yeah, absolutely delighted. I remember he was really anxious because his two sons had been really bad sleepers. Like they both didn't sleep through the night or for longer than like 45 minutes until they were like 4 years old. And so he was really worried about that. But thankfully, we were like blessed from the heavens above and we have a dream baby. So that's good. So then we went with an obstetrician, and that's because of my, like I mentioned, I have really bad health anxiety, and I really wanted like regular scans, like more than the two scans that you get with a midwife. And we went with Dr. Nick Walker from Origins, which I picked him because I heard Julia Matthews in one of your episodes say that she really loved him. So I went with him, and we were really lucky to get in because his books are full all the time. And as amazing as he was, and he's such a good obstetrician, and he, you know, is amazing at making sure your baby is safe and healthy. If I reflect on it, I think I would have really benefited from more holistic care, which I might have gotten from a midwife because of the hyperemesis, and you know, my mental health was in, you know, tatters. Nick, as he should be, was primarily focused on the health of the baby, And so at times I sort of felt like, well, what about me? Like I know the baby's healthy and that's great, but I'm not doing well. And so it did start to feel a bit like Handmaid's Tale vibes, like I'm just this vessel carrying this baby and people don't really care about me. So if I was to do it again, I think I'd still go with an obstetrician because we loved him and it was so reassuring to see the baby all the time and know that she was fine. But I think if it was possible, I'd love to have like a midwife as well to just take care of me and make sure I'm all right as well.
That is so important. And I've never had an obstetrician, so obviously can't talk to like the differences, but I'm sure there'll be people who listen to this episode and resonate with those feelings as well. Cool. And so you are under an obstetrician care. Did you do all of the sort of standard testing? I know you were getting more regular scans, but did you do like all of the other testing that's offered in New Zealand? And did you want to find out the sex of your baby as well?
Yes, so we did every test that was going, because obviously I'm a anxious nut, and we did the NIP test, and finding out the gender was so important to me, and I so desperately wanted a girl because we already had two boys, obviously, and also because me and my mum, like my mum was a single mum for a lot of the time, and it was just me and her, and we were so close. It was like Gilmore Girls vibes. And so I really wanted a daughter because I really wanted to sort of recreate that Lorelai and Rory vibe, and because that would like it was I felt like it was going to make me feel connected to my mum if I had that with my daughter. And so yeah, it turns out we did have a girl, so that was amazing.
Amazing. And how did you go with like in terms of I know you got hyperemesis, did you have that for your whole pregnancy? Like what were your pregnancy symptoms sort of from trimester one onwards?
Yes, so trimester one, I obviously had morning sickness, which kind of clouds my memory, and I can't remember any other symptoms I had because that was so dominating. You know what I mean? Like I was so unwell. And so by 12 weeks, it hadn't gone away and it was getting worse, not better. And so I think Nick said, oh, this could be hyperemesis. But don't worry, we'll get you on the meds, and it will probably go away by 20 weeks. And yeah, so throughout my pregnancy, I was put on every single anti-nausea drug under the sun, like tried all five of them, tried a combo of them, nothing worked. But he was like, don't worry, because 99% of the time, hyperemesis goes away by 20 weeks. So I remembered just counting down the days till I got to 20 weeks, and I was like, I've just got to make it like 6 more days and then this will be gone. 20 weeks came and went and it just got worse, and I think that's when like a Nick, our obstetrician, was like, okay, so you must be like the 1% where it lasts right through your pregnancy up until you give birth. And I think finding that out, that was just the beginning of my downfall mentally, because I was just like, this is not going to be a good 6 more months. And so yeah, the hyperemesis was horrific. Nick later told me after I'd had my daughter that he was like, I didn't want to say this at the time, but it's the worst case I've ever seen in my 25-year career. And I sort of said to him, like, I kind of wish you had told me that at the time, because it would have really validated my experience, because I just felt like I was weak or I was over dramatic. But yeah, it was just hideous. Like I was couch bound basically the whole 9 months. I had barely any social life, but when I would try to go out with friends, but I was just on the brink of fainting because I was so dehydrated and malnourished. I'd go out to dinner with them and then I'd have to leave and I'd like vomit in the gutter outside the restaurant, or I'd vomit all over myself while driving home. I felt like such a shit wife because I wasn't working, so I wasn't contributing financially to our family. And but then on the, at the same time, I couldn't even get, like, I couldn't empty the dishwasher, I couldn't vacuum, like, I couldn't do anything because I was so sick. And also in the second trimester, that's when, you know, your baby starts moving or in your tummy, and that's supposed to be this beautiful, amazing thing. But for me, her wriggling around made me feel even more nauseous. So I hated it. And at the same time, yeah, I'm a journalist, and the Herald had asked me to write a pregnancy, like a weekly pregnancy column for them, thinking, like, because I'm usually, like, traditionally, like, I'm a really, like, funny writer, and I write, like, you know, comedic stuff. So I think they had commissioned me to do that, thinking that that was what it was going to be, like, this funny take on pregnancy. And it was just such a depressing read every week. Like, I remember my dad said, he was like, this is the biggest form of contraception for teenagers. Like, you are really not selling pregnancy. And also in second trimester, because I put a lot of weight on through being on antidepressants and doing IVF, when I got hyperemesis, I started losing weight, and obviously you were supposed to gain weight when you're pregnant to make like a cozy home for your baby, but I was losing weight because I was so sick. And I remember I had such conflicting feelings about this, because I liked that I was losing all this weight, and I was starting to look like how I looked like before I was on meds, before I did IVF. So I secretly loved it, but at the same time, I knew it wasn't healthy. I knew it wasn't good for the baby. And, you know, people would say, like, you know, like, strangers, not strangers, but people I knew would be like, you look amazing, you're so hot now that you're, you know, being pregnant. But my husband was like, you don't look amazing, like, this isn't what you're meant to look like. You're a curvy girl, you don't look good, you're not supposed to be half the size you were at 6 months pregnant. So that, yeah, that was hard. And then also, as I said, I've got two stepsons, and I think when you don't have like that biological bond, because they're not your biological children, you have to really work hard to maintain that relationship with your stepchildren, which I just did not have capacity to do. Like, up until that point, we had always been so close, and I'm like a fun mom, like, you know, I would do hide and seek and play fun games. And then when I got hyperemesis, I just couldn't do anything. I couldn't be bothered, I didn't have the energy, and so I really drifted away from my stepsons, which was just awful. And then I remember 2 weeks after I gave birth to my daughter, so, you know, I was still like, I had C-sections, raw scar, and I'd had 1 hour sleep, but I remember driving one of my stepsons to an airplane toy shop, like an hour out of Auckland, on 1 hour sleep, just because I was like, I need to repair our relationship as soon as possible. Like, I need my kids back. So yeah, so that was hard.
Yeah. And there's like, obviously so many different parts of that for you. But I think, like, if for someone who has never heard of hyperemesis before, and obviously you talk about like the weight loss and the like feeling like you're not contributing around the house, but can you just explain to us, like, what did a normal sort of day look like for you in your pregnancy? Like, how often were you sick? What was your actual experience day to day?
So day to day wouldn't even start in the day. The day to day would start in the night, where my nausea was so bad that it would wake me up, like it would wake me from my sleep. And I would be vomiting through the night. And then I'd wake up in the morning with a migraine because I was so dehydrated. I'd try to eat something. And, you know, they say, like, eat plain toast, eat crackers. That doesn't, for me anyway, that didn't do shit. Like, no matter what I ate, I would vomit. So I would eat breakfast, vomit it up, lie on the couch, watch TikTok for 8 hours, try eat again. Vomit, try, have some dinner, vomit. So I was just not keeping any food down. But I knew, like, the doctors had all said, they're like, I know this is horrible for you and you're basically starving, but don't worry, your baby's still getting all the nutrients she needs, so she's fine. But what they hadn't told me was, but if you can't keep down water for, you know, 48 hours, you'd need to go to the ER. And I didn't realize that until I was about 8 months pregnant, and I hadn't kept any water down or food, obviously, in, I don't know, like a few days. And I started feeling like I felt like I was about to black out. Like I felt like I was losing consciousness. So I said to my husband, because he was at work, and I was like, I'm going to Uber to the hospital. I'm probably fine, but I'll keep you posted. And I got there and they put the heart rate monitors on my stomach, and they were like, oh, this isn't good. Like, your baby's heart's going way too fast. She must be really dehydrated. She's in distress. They had to call Nick and say, like, you might have to come deliver the baby early. And it turns out she, after I had like 5 bags of IV fluids, she was fine and she calmed down. But I was so angry because I was like, why did you not tell me that? Like, my baby was in distress and I didn't know. And imagine if I hadn't gone to ER, like, what would have happened? Through the second trimester with the hyperemesis as well, while when my daughter got bigger, like as she was growing, she was obviously so big on my organs, and so I would feel even sicker. And I couldn't even hold down like one cracker because she was just sitting on my stomach. And she was also, because she was so heavy on my bladder, every time I would vomit, I would piss myself. And so I know it's just, it gets worse and worse. So yeah, by the last few months, I was wearing like adult nappies. Like, it was just so mortifying on every level. I had like burst blood vessels around my eyes. I ended up with a flared rib. Like, one of my rib bones was sort of kicked out of place by the baby or by the vomiting. And it was the most agonizing pain I've ever had in my life. Like, I was taking Tramadol like every 2 hours all day, and I was crying, crying, crying from this rib pain. Like, you could see the rib bone sort of sticking out of my skin. And I also, because I was so faint all the time from being so malnourished, I keep having accidents. Like, I would like slip over on the footpath. Or I, when I was 9 months pregnant, I dropped this big concrete statue on my foot. Because I was just so clumsy because I was so malnourished. I dropped the statue on my foot, broke my foot, was in a moon boot at 9 months pregnant with this broken rib, so sick. Like, and so I was obviously like in such a dark place. And I was just having really dark days and dark thoughts sometimes, which, like, I was like, I can't, like, I would say to my husband, I literally can't do this anymore. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, I'm gonna have to have an abortion. Like, I can't do this. And I felt so ashamed. And it wasn't until after I'd had my baby and I started reading up about hyperemesis and trying to raise money for the organizations and stuff, that I learned that 50% of women with hyperemesis consider abortion, 20% consider suicide, and 10% end up terminating their pregnancies. Like, that's how bad it was. And so I was like, okay, I'm not alone. But yeah, it was at that point that, in hindsight, I think I should have been put on antidepressants.
And like, through all of this, did you have any time to think about anything else? Like, were you thinking about the point where you have to give birth to your baby? Like, were you interested at all in any birth education? Like, what did that side of the pregnancy look like for you, knowing that like eventually you were going to give birth to your baby?
So I knew right from the get-go that I was going to have an elective C-section because I obviously have really bad, I have, even before I was pregnant, I had really severe anxiety. I don't handle uncertainty well, or not knowing when things are going to happen, like in terms of when I was going to go into labor, how long it would go on for. And then because I was so sick and in such a bad way, mentally and physically, that just reinstated, how I was like, I'm definitely having an elective C-section. So I did your birth project course, and sort of just did the C-section part of it and all the stuff around like anxiety, trying to be in a good place and stuff, which definitely helped me in the lead up to the birth. But as I'll get to, when I was on the operating table having a full-blown panic attack. I'm sorry to say, but it all kind of went out the window. Like
My
I
God,
was,
I can only imagine.
yeah. And
Yeah.
I hate that because I wanted to say to you, like, in your course, like, save the day. But I was beyond help at that point. But then, in terms of birth education, we decided to do an antenatal class. And I was the one that drove that because obviously my husband had had two babies. So he was like, I don't really need to go to a class. But it was really important for me to go because I didn't have many friends who had babies. And so we didn't have family around. And so it was really important for me to sort of make, I mean, I hate this term, it's so cringe, but like make a little village, like make friends with other mums that I could talk to. Like I thought, you know, maybe we'll message every now and then or maybe meet up once a month. But it turned out like we paid $200 for this class and it is literally the best money we've ever spent. Like that group of mums that I met at my antenatal class are now like my number one friends, basically. Like I hang out with them every day. It's such an incredible group. Like we can, you know, share all the hard stuff with each other, and it's just a no judgment zone, safe space. And I don't know, especially because, you know, my pregnancy was so awful, and after I had my daughter, that was a really hard time. And I honestly wouldn't have gone through it without this group of women.
I think like that is my favorite part of hearing people talking about antenatal classes. Like often the actual birth education can be a bit.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hit or miss, but the group of friends or like the people that you meet there are just like worth their weight in gold.
Absolutely. Like they, and I think as well, like with a group of mums, when your babies are all the same age, you're all in the thick of it together, you're messaging in the middle of the night, those friendships are accelerated so much faster than traditional friendships. Like, you know, I've known them 3 months, but, and they're, you know, not to exaggerate or anything, but they're like my best friends now because you are living the same life. You've got everything in common. You're having the shared experiences. You see them most days, and so obviously I have my normal best friends, but this group of women is right up there.
Amazing. And were there any plans for like when you're thinking elective C-section dates and like getting to full term and all of that sort of stuff, knowing how unwell you were with hyperemesis and also your mental health, like not being in a great place, what was the plan around your C-section date and like how far along were they planning to do that?
Yeah, so basically, obviously the ideal time to have a baby is 40 weeks because by that point they're, you know, fully grown, they're ready for the world. But I was in such a bad way that Nick was like, okay, I'm willing to do it at 39 weeks because the baby's lungs should be fully developed by then. Like obviously there's no guarantee. Sometimes babies do need to, you know, be put on a breathing tube or go to NICU or whatever, but that we've got pretty good chance of her being all good at 39 weeks. But I think by 37 weeks, I was just in, yeah, I couldn't go any longer. And so I remember, like, because I remember starting off with my appointments with Nick once a month or whatever, and I would come in, and I'm such a people pleasing loser that I would be like making jokes and being so friendly. And through those 9 months, each appointment, I just came in just in it, you know, even more deteriorated. And then by 37 weeks, that 37 week appointment, I just walked in and I just was crying my eyes out. And I was like, you have to take this baby out. But I could barely speak. And Stu was with me and he was like, you have to take the baby out. Like, she can't go any longer. Like, I need my wife back. Like, I don't think you understand how bad this is. And like, Nick quite rightly so, was like, I know she's, you know, she's in such a bad place, but like, I have to look after the baby. Like, I can't take this baby out and put her at risk. Even though, like, he totally validated how much I was suffering, but it was so hard to get that balance right, because we had to look after the baby. We didn't want her to come out and be on tubes and NICU, like, and I felt so guilty that I felt like it's so wrong of me to put myself before the baby, but that I was so sick. So we were begging with him, and eventually he was like, okay, I can do it at 38 weeks. Like, if you're willing, you know, like, you have to accept the risks and stuff. There's a chance that she will have to go to NICU, but she'll probably be fine. So I was like, okay, yep, for sure. Like, I'll, you know, as soon as you can do it, that's fine with me. I accept the risks. Because I had to by that point. And so I remember he was like, okay, we'll just like, hang by the phone and I'll get you a date for your C-section. And I remember he gave us that date, and it was for 39 weeks. So it was like right at the tail end of 38 weeks. And so basically 39 weeks, and nothing had changed. It wasn't going to be any earlier. And I just lost it, like, crying. Cause I was like, you promised me. And he was like, okay, I'm so sorry. Like, that was the best I could do, but why don't I put you on like an on-call standby list, which means that if someone has their baby early or has to cancel their C-section, we can get you in last minute. And so I was like, okay, yeah, let's do that. I'll join the waiting list. Like, we are on standby at an airport, basically. And so I remember he called on Sunday night, and he was like, a slot's become available for Monday morning. So that was like the 29th of July. So do you want that slot? And we're like, absolutely. And because I'm such a freak who like wants, you know, good content for the gram, I call Fiona Goddard, who I think you've done an episode with. And yes, I was like, I was like, last minute, but I'm having a C-section tomorrow morning. Could you please come round and blow wave my hair and do my makeup?
So, oh, I love that.
Despite being on like death's door, that was where my head was at. I was like, I've got to get a great gram. So next morning comes, Fiona's 10 minutes away, and Dr. Nick calls, and he's like, I'm so sorry, the slot's been filled, like, you're not having your C-section today. And I just broke down. I think I hung up on him. I was like, I don't even want to talk to you. I hung up, cried my eyes out, had to text Fiona being like, don't worry about the blow wave, it's not happening. And I just went to bed and cried all day. But then later that night, we got another call, and they were like, look, another slot's opened up tomorrow. It's not a definite, but you can hang out at the hospital all day, and hopefully a slot will become available. And we were like, okay, we'll do that. So we packed my bags. I didn't get a blow wave. I was like, look, we're not going through that again. I can't muck the order around. So we went in on August 1st, and we spent the whole day in the pre-op waiting room. Like, I was in a gown, and we were just sitting there waiting, basically. But by that point, I was vomiting in the pre-op waiting room. I had like a horrific migraine. And so eventually, and I was with all the other mums who were hoping to get a C-section, but thank God a nurse like came in, and she saw how bad it was. And she was like, okay, I'm moving you to a private room. Like, you know, you're clearly really sick, so we're going to make you a priority, which sucked for the other mums. But I was like, don't care about you guys at this point. Like, I need to get this baby out. So we went to the private room. We were there for a couple of hours, and then all of a sudden this nurse rushes in, and she was like, look, we can do it in 15 minutes. Are you ready? And we were like, oh my God, like, okay. But obviously I was vomiting my head off, and I started, because it was only 15 minutes notice, I started to really panic. And I was like, I think I need to be put to sleep. Like, I can't be awake for this. But they were like, okay, like, are you sure? Because if you get put to sleep, you won't see your baby be born, and you might regret that. And I was like, okay, like, I don't want to be a cop out, so I'll try be awake. And she was like, look, there's this thing we can give you. It's like this relaxing drug that will just relax your body and your mind, and so you'll be in like a, you know, pretty dreamy state. And I was like, yes, sweet, like, shoot me up with that ASAP. So then I got taken to the operating room. By that point, I was having a full panic attack. They put the epidural in, and then they gave me this relaxing drug. And I was like, okay, like everything's gonna be fine. I'm gonna go into a blissed out zone. I can do this. But the relaxing drug was, for me anyway, absolutely horrific. It basically, instead of relaxing my body, it made me feel like my drink had been spiked. Like I felt
No.
absolutely, like just on another planet, not in a good way. I was slurring my words and I was trying to say to them, I was like, this hasn't worked. This has made it worse. You need to put me to sleep. But that I was slurring my words and I started to panic even more because I was like, they can't understand what I'm saying.
Oh,
They're going to
yeah.
start cutting me open and they can't hear me saying I need to go to sleep. And I think I reached out and yanked Stu, my husband, towards me. And he just looked in my eyes and he knew. And he was like, you have to put her to sleep right now, like right now. And then that's all I remember. And then I woke up an hour later, and they had said, because she had to leave the room for the C-section, and they had said, look, when she comes around, she's going to be really groggy. She might be quite upset because, she had to be put to sleep. She didn't get to see Vivi be born. She's going to be, really drowsy. So just be prepared for that. He comes in, my eyes ping open, and I'm like, hello. And the nurses were like, we've never seen anything like this. Like, I was just pinged awake, and he handed me the baby. And even though I was just coming to from a general anesthetic and I was drugged up, I was like, get your phone out, film a video of me. We need the gram.
Oh, love it. The dedication is there. It's good.
Always, always committed to the gram.
Yeah, amazing. And so, do you remember, like, can you vividly remember that phase, like that period of time afterwards? Like, when did you get to meet Vivi? What was Shu doing? Yeah, talk us through that whole experience.
I really don't remember much, and I only remember it because I have that video of me like absolutely drugged out of my mind, smiling at this baby. But that's all I really remember, until I guess a couple of hours later, like the post-birth phase, where I was taken to my room with the baby, and I felt high as a kite. I was just like deliriously happy. Like I was like, it was like I was on drugs. Like I just felt so groovy and stoked because obviously my baby was out, and so I didn't feel sick. And I remember saying to Stu, I was like, I feel so good. And I was like, why don't we get an Uber and like go out to Ponsonby tonight? He was like, are you joking? He was like, you've just had a baby, you're paralyzed from the waist down. And I was like, no, I'm fine, put me in a wheelchair. And I remember, and then I posted this video on Insta because I was like, I'm gonna wait a few days. I'm just gonna, before I announce the baby on social media, I'm just gonna soak up this newborn baby bubble. Like, don't like turn my phone off. Didn't. Obviously, 10 minutes after she's born, I'm like editing this video of her together, putting on a beautiful Taylor Swift song on it, chucking it on the gram with this caption. And the caption, it was like, last day of my nightmare, first day of my forever girl, or something so cringe, which is so off brand for me. Like, I don't write stuff like that. And also, I look back on that now and I'm like, what a joke saying the nightmare's over, like it's all behind me, because it's like, little do you know, 2 weeks later, you're going to be in a psych ward with postnatal
Oh God. And how were you like physically? Because I've had a C-section too. And I remember like that feeling of first trying to stand up and like all of those first shower, like all of that. How were you physically after your cesarean? Like, when did you do all of those things, and how were you finding, yeah, that first sort of 24 hours after your birth?
So the first 24 hours, physically, I felt fine because I was obviously jacked up on morphine. And I remember the nurse came in and she was like, how are you? And I was like, oh my God, I don't know why people say C-section recovery is tough. I don't feel anything. And she was like, yeah, you're like on a morphine drip. And obviously, because I felt high as a kite, I couldn't sleep the entire first night that she was born. So I stayed awake all night like I was on a bender. And I was messaging absolute randoms on Facebook that I hadn't spoken to in years, being like, I just had a baby. Here's a photo of her. And like randoms I went to primary school with. And they were like, okay, cool, I don't care. And then eventually everyone in New Zealand went to sleep because it was like midnight. So I started messaging people who I knew who lived overseas, like, and we're in a different time zone. Like, I was just, like, being an absolute lunatic. And so it wasn't until I got moved to birth care and obviously taken off my amazing morphine drip that I was in a lot of pain, and I was like, okay, like, this actually is that.
And was there, like, were you still taking, I think they gave, what did they give me? Maybe tramadol or codeine or something for the pain. Like, were you still taking pain relief when you went to birth care, or did they just sort of get you off it? What was the go there?
Yeah, I was still taking tramadol, I think. I was taking everything except for morphine, but I was still in so much pain. And also, I had read about this really rare thing, which of course happens to me, which is that... if you've heard of it, it's that trapped gas pain in your shoulder.
Oh, yes. I've never had anyone on the podcast with that, but I have heard of it.
Yeah, so it's very rare. So, of course, I am the 1%. And I remember, I was in pain from the C-section, but I was all good. And one of my best friends, Hannah, turned up to birth care to visit me and meet Vivi. And I, like, she came in the room and I opened my mouth to say, like, hi, welcome. And I just remember screaming because I had this pain that was so unbearable in the tip of my shoulder, like on my right on top of my shoulder. And my obstetrician was like, oh yeah, like, I should have warned you about that, but I didn't think it happened to you, on top of the hyperemesis and everything. But he was like, it's, people compare it to like a crocodile biting down on your shoulder, like that feeling of teeth piercing your skin. So that was awful, and tramadol, like, nothing really touches the sides, but thank God it only lasted a couple of hours, I think, and then I just had like the standard C-section pain to deal with.
And what about your, like, hormones and how you're feeling mentally postnatally at that stage? Did you notice, like, people often talk about a change in hormones when your milk comes in. Like, how were you finding breastfeeding? What was going on with all of that?
So mentally, I still felt fine at this point. I initially had decided before I had Vivi that I was like, I'll give breastfeeding a go, but if I'm not into it for whatever reason or it's not easy, then I'll stop. But obviously, when you have your baby and you get to birth care and there's all those breast is best posters and stuff, it sort of seeps into you, and you do start to feel like, oh, you know, breast is best, like, I have to push through the pain and do this for my baby. Like, if I switch to formula, that's a cop out, she's not getting all the nutrients she needs, which isn't really true. And so I breastfed for 12 days, and I realized, I was like, no, this isn't working, like, I need to go back to the original plan, because I would be crying while I was doing it. Also, my boobs were so swollen from the C-section, because obviously your body swells up, that my milk was trapped, so it was really painful. She was so hungry, and also I was, you know, I'd been so sick, and I have really high sleep needs because of my mental illnesses, that I, you know, I was like, I need to put her on formula so that Stu can share the load and he can get up and give her bottles in the night, because I need sleep. I need sleep to recover from the C-section, from, you know, everything I've been through. And also I was like, I just want my body back. Like, I've been so sick for 9 months. I want my body back. I don't want to be in pain anymore. I would love a glass of wine. Yeah. You know what I mean? So mentally, once I made that decision, that was great. In terms of the postpartum hormones, I didn't experience that baby blues sort of drop until we got home from birth care a few days later. And I remember we got home and I put her into a cot, and I came downstairs and just burst into tears because I was thinking about one day she will get old and she'll be an old lady and she'll die. And I remember just crying my eyes out. And then I think the next day it got worse because my husband's sister and her family were coming to visit to meet the baby. And they said, they're like, we'll be there at 2 p.m. And we had just, we'd just gotten home from something and it was 12 o'clock. And I was like, okay, I've got time to have a shower, wash my hair, try to shave my legs, all of that, you know, like get cozy and feel fresh for these visitors. And they turned up 2 hours early as I'd just gone into the shower and I was obviously still bleeding. I couldn't, we had our body, like a shower gel on the floor. I couldn't, because of my C-section, I couldn't bend over to reach it. So I couldn't wash myself. I couldn't put my like maternity nappy thing on. And so I was crying and I was so angry at Stu because he was downstairs talking to them. And I was so angry at them for turning up early. And so I think, that's when the hormones obviously hit me and I was just really upset and overwhelmed.
And did you notice like it was slowly getting worse? What were you like experiencing throughout like the next couple of days after that? Because I know that you ended up like back in hospital after a couple of weeks. So how did you sort of get to that point?
So after... Yeah, so that baby blues came. I had a rough couple of days, as I mentioned, you know, the crying and just melting down. And then it went away. And I was like, okay, that's, you know, that's great. That was just standard baby blues. Yep. People talk about that. It's fleeting, all good. And then over the next week or so, I started getting intrusive thoughts. Like I would be holding my baby. And it's weird because I would, if I was carrying her down the stairs, I would grip onto the handrail because I was so paranoid of dropping her. Do you know, like I was so protective of her. I was so careful and so cautious not to hurt her. You know, obviously like I loved her so much, wouldn't want anything to happen to her. But at the same time, sometimes I would walk past like my coffee table and I would just get this thought pop into my mind like, oh, I could bash her head on the coffee table. And that was so distressing. And I was like, how am I having these thoughts pop in while at the same time being so careful not to bump her into anything or drop her? And so it's so confusing. And I felt so ashamed of it, of these intrusive thoughts, because I would never act on them. I didn't want to bang her head into the coffee table. I was like, why are these thoughts coming in? Like, what's wrong with me? And it wasn't until talking to one of my antenatal mum friends, like who's a psychologist, because I was like, should I talk to her? And so then I finally plucked up the courage and I was like, hey, this is random, but I'm having these thoughts of banging her head onto the coffee table. And she was like, yeah, same. She was like, I was eating a bag of M&Ms the other day and I thought about chucking one in the baby's mouth, like, so he choked. And she was like, I would never do it, but intrusive thoughts are totally normal. So many mums have them. We know you'd never act on them. It's nothing to be ashamed of. So once I heard that, the thoughts actually went away. Like, it's like as once they were validated and I wasn't afraid of them, they stopped popping into my head. So that was good. But then... yeah, that week or the weeks that followed, I started to get really physically sick. Like I started getting migraines again. I was vomiting again. And I was like, what the hell? Like, is the hyperemesis back? Like, this doesn't make sense. I was running really hot and cold. So I was either freezing and shaking or I was drenched in sweat. And then I started to think, I was like, has something gone wrong with my C-section? Like, have they left an instrument in me or have I been poisoned? And because I was like, this isn't right. And also at the same time, what started to happen was when my daughter woke up in the night crying, I could not get up. Like, I felt like I had like concrete bricks on my chest weighing me down. I couldn't wake up to feed her. And I remember I messaged one of my mum friends who has two daughters and I was like, something's wrong with me, like I can't get up. And also Stu was doing all the night feeds, so I was sleeping like 12 hours all night, couldn't get up for the baby, I mean, great night's sleep, but still waking up feeling like I hadn't slept at all. And she was like, that's not right. She was like, you're like, that's not you being lazy or whatever. Like, that something's wrong. Because she was like, biologically, like caveman vibes, mums have to, like, you know, something propels them to get out of bed to feed their babies, even if they're really tired. So the fact that you literally can't get up, something's wrong. And so coupled with all the physical symptoms, like, I, you know, the headaches and vomiting, I was like, yeah, this isn't right. So me and Stu went to my GP and she ran all these tests and she was like, look, nothing's physically wrong with you. Your C-section incision looks fine. You don't have an infection. You're all good. And I burst into tears because I was like, I'm not all good. Like, something is really wrong. Like, you're missing something. And she was like, I honestly think this is a mental health thing. You need to go to a psychiatrist. And I was like, it's not mental. Like, I'm not sad. I'm not crying. I love my baby. I'm not depressed. I'm sick. Like, I feel like I've got, like, the worst flu in the world. And she was like, look, go see your psychiatrist. So I walked into my psychiatrist's office, Giselle, and I just burst into tears. And she looked, because she's known me for years, she just took one look at me and she was like, you have severe postnatal depression. I'm calling Starship and I'm booking you a bed and you have to go there this afternoon. And so that was awful. So I had to stay at the mum and baby unit at Starship for a week, and not because, like, they thought I was any danger to myself or my baby. It was more because when you get put on meds at the start, you have to go up in dosage really slowly. Like, you take a small dose for a week or two and then they'll crank it up a little bit and then they crank it up a little bit more. But if I stayed in the mum and baby unit, they would be able to ramp my meds up really fast because they'd be able to monitor like my blood pressure and stuff.
Yeah.
So I stayed there for a week and I hated every minute of it because I had this new, like, brand new baby, and my husband Stu couldn't stay with me obviously because he had to be home to be with our other kids. So I was on my own in there, just, like, so frightened, trying to learn how to look after this baby on my own, because for the first 2 weeks of her life, my husband had obviously been doing everything, like making bottles and changing nappies and stuff because I was recovering from a C-section. So then I was utterly thrown in the deep end in this kind of scary environment, on my own, and it was just... yeah, it was really awful and I was really sad. But after I got put on meds, it was like day and night. Like, I was instantly better. All the physical symptoms went away. I wasn't sick anymore. I had energy. I could feed her. And so, like, as hard as that was being away from my husband in, like, a kind of scary place, it was, like, the best decision for our family.
Yeah. And did you find, like, the way that you were feeling and, like, all of these symptoms that you were having as a result of the postnatal depression, did they take long with the meds to, like, change? Like, what was your experience while you were actually there? And then how did you make the transition back to being at home?
So, honestly, like, as soon as, I don't know if it's like a placebo effect, but basically as soon as I took the first pill, the symptoms went away. And it was probably because, like, they had been able to diagnose me, so I wasn't frightened anymore. I knew what was wrong with me. I knew that I was going to get better really soon, and I didn't have to be scared anymore because they had figured out what the problem was. I knew that, like, you know, help was here. And so even though the meds probably hadn't taken any physical effect, like, the placebo effect made me feel better. And as hard as it was being in, like, a that kind of environment, like a psych ward kind of environment where you do feel like, you know, you're a crazy person, the staff there are just wonderful. Like, they would sit with me and hold my hand while I, like, cried and talked about how hard my pregnancy had been and how my baby didn't look like what I thought she'd look like, and how I thought that I was supposed to feel this overwhelming love for her, like, love at first sight. I didn't feel like that. She was, like, a stranger to me. Obviously, I knew I was compelled to look after her, but I didn't feel like she was my baby. And they just would hold my hand for hours and let me cry and tell me that all of that's totally normal. Lots of mums feel like that. And it's not until their babies start like smiling and interacting that you and having that reciprocal relationship that you do start to feel that bond. So yeah, they're amazing. And also while I was there, they taught me how to give her a bath, you know, like they gave her a bath with me and they showed me how to swaddle and like they just, yeah, they're such wonderful people there. And so as well as getting me better on meds and giving me like free therapy, they also taught me all this practical stuff that made me feel really empowered and like I could do this without Stu. Like I was perfectly capable and I was going to be fine, you know, on my own. Not that I'm on my own, but you know. So yeah, so I was there for I think 5 days and then I came home and yeah, everything was groovy from there, thank God.
Amazing. And how have you found things since then? So talk us through your experience as a mum since you left the hospital and like you've got the medication that you needed and you feel a little bit more confident in yourself and like, you know, your ability to do things with Vivi. How has your life been since?
So this is like the happiest I've ever been in my life. And I honestly think it's because I went through such a dark time. I now don't take my health for granted. I don't take anything for granted. Like all these little things, like the sun's shining in the sky. It's a beautiful day. Like all of these things, like I just like appreciate so much now because I had such an awful time. And now Vivi's, she's 3 months old and she's smiling and she only wants me to hold her and it's just so nice. And so now we've totally got that, like, you know, that bond and I'm obsessed with her. On a day to day, it is really hard juggling three kids, especially with the age gap, because obviously, you know, my husband works, and he works quite late in the evenings. And so I'm running around town, like taking the boys to their sports while juggling Vivi and cooking dinner and doing all of that. And that's really difficult. But I recently at one of my, you know, like baby sensory classes, I was having a big vent about how hard it is, you know, as happy as I am, it's really tough. And one of the mums was like, why don't you just find like a little teenager on your community Facebook page to come help you in the afternoons? And I was like, no, like I'm not like a, you know, a rich mum who's going to outsource and get help. Like I can manage, I'm fine. And she was like, it's not just rich mums who need help. Like all mums need help. Three kids is a lot. And there's nothing like, there's nothing shameful or, you know, anything like that about getting help. And so yeah, her saying that, I was like, okay, you're right. So I've recently got it's the older sister of one of my stepson's friends and she comes in the afternoons and helps me like empty the dishwasher and take the boys to soccer. And that's really good because while I could do it all myself, like it would mean that in my tiny pockets of free time when Vivi's asleep and the boys are at football or whatever, I'm emptying the dishwasher, I'm doing laundry. It means that by the time the evening comes and Vivi's in bed, I feel so sad because I haven't gotten to just sit and hold her. Do you know what I mean? Because I've got so much on my plate that I don't have that nice time with her. And at the same time, because I was just couch bound for 9 months, I am now really wanting to make up for lost time. So I'm like going out for boozy lunches or going shopping or like, you know, going to the movies and hooning Vivi around town doing all this stuff because I couldn't do it for so long. But I'm definitely, I've realized in the past couple of weeks, I'm definitely overdoing it because I'm, you know, exhausted. And also I don't want to miss, I don't want to look back and regret this first few months with her where she does want to sleep on my chest and she wants to be cuddled because I'm hooning around town doing silly errands that actually don't matter. Do you know what I mean? And also I think I've sort of created a monster because Vivi has been driving around town to nail appointments and pubs since she was like a week old, and so now she hates being at home doing nothing. She will only sleep in the car or at the nail salon. So yeah, I'm trying to slow down for her and for me, because I don't want her to not be able to relax. Like, I find it really difficult to relax and do nothing. I don't want that for her. But also last night I got really frustrated with her because I was wanting to do something. I can't remember what it was, like some little bit of work, and she was crying and I got really angry because I was like, I just miss being able to do what I want when I want. But then I was thinking about it later that night, and I was like, actually, if you flip that round, this is actually a good thing. I can't do what I want when I want all the time, because that will mean I'm forced to slow down, you know, and I'm forced to just sit with her and not rush through things and not do everything all the time. Like, those things don't matter. This is, being with her is what matters.
I think, like, there's lots of different parts of your experience that I think, like, different people will relate to. But that feeling of, like, having, you know, like, no time with your newborn baby because you've got older kids in the house, and like the juggle, and feeling like you can't or don't want to reach out for help because you don't want to be like one of those people. I think, like, and you said earlier, like, the word village, but I think the reality is, like, a village is the way that a lot of us survive through this motherhood journey, because it is really hard to do things. Like, you just can't do everything on your own. And it's really nice to hear that you've found, like, a way that you can, you know, have someone else there to do some of the things for you, because, like, doing it all on your own is just, really hard work.
Totally. And honestly, the biggest thing, or the most important person in my village, is who is looking after my baby right now while I do this podcast, is this woman, Jane. So when I was about 6 months pregnant, me and my husband signed up to this organization called Grand Friends, which is a little organization that matches families who don't have grandparents in their lives with older people who don't have, you know, family in their lives.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
And it's amazing. And we met this lady, Jane, through it, who, she's with Vivi right now downstairs. And yeah, because my mum, like I said, died when I was younger, and my dad's not around, and Stu's parents are older and they live in a retirement village in Nelson. In Hamilton. And so, yeah, we met Jane when I was 6 months pregnant, and we got to know her, and, you know, went for coffee with her all the time. And now she's just part of our family. She's Vivi's granny, and she takes her out for walks whenever I need a break, or takes her to the beach because I hate the beach. And, you know, people come stop her and they're like, oh, cute baby, and she's like, yeah, this is my granddaughter Vivi. And she, when I had her, she cooked like 30 dinners for us to have in the freezer. She drops around at a moment's notice whenever I need her. And it's also lovely for me to have like a surrogate mother figure, you know, like, she's wants to teach me how to cook, and she, you know, she'll run the vacuum around the house and look after me, and if I'm going through hard times, she'll, you know, give me a big cuddle. And it's just so lovely for me. It's so lovely for her, I think, to have this new granddaughter. And it's so lovely for Vivi that she will grow up with a grandma that she otherwise wouldn't have had without my mum, you know.
Oh, that's lovely. That's really nice that you've found, like, that person in your support system. And I'm sure she absolutely adores it as well.
Oh, yeah. Vivi is, like, I don't even matter to her anymore. It's all about Vivi.
Oh, that's so nice. And is there anything else, Sinead, that we haven't covered in your story that's important to you to share? Or, yeah, anything else that you want to include?
I guess just that I am now in this hard place where I really want another baby, because I, like, Vivi obviously has her big brothers, but they're like 10 years older than her, and I really want her to have, it's always been important for me to have at least two you know, children close in age so that they grow up together. Because when I lost my mum, I didn't have that. Like, I was on my own. But my husband, obviously, he's 48 now. He's, you know, got three children. We can't really afford a fourth. And also, he, you know, he's exhausted. So that's hard. And also, I have such a high chance of having hyperemesis again that he's just like, I don't know if I can watch you go through that. And so I'm finding that really difficult because, yeah, I really want another baby. And so the past few weeks I've actually been, like, looking into surrogacy because I'm like, maybe that could be an option. Do you know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't, as much as I'd want to carry my own baby, I would be so sick then I can't risk that again. So this would be a way around that. And so I'm definitely wanting to look further into that. So if anybody hears this and wants to be my surrogate, that'd be very grateful.
I'll make sure we make that like a trailer for the episode.
Yes, please, that'd be great.
I think there'll again be lots of people who can relate to that feeling of like desperately wanting another child, but the reality of your pregnancy and like the potential of that happening again while already having three children in your house, like, yeah, I can totally understand why you're looking into alternate options, because it's just not like realistic or something that you would ever want to do.
Well, totally. And a part of me is like, oh, am I even like deserving of a surrogate? Because, you know, like same-sex couples who need one, who don't have any other options, they should be the ones who get the very limited surrogates in this country. But then I'm like, well, maybe what I went through is valid, you know, like I was so sick in hospital every 48 hours, like in a really dark mental place. Maybe that's okay too. If I got a surrogate, if there's enough to go around, you know.
No, I definitely think so. I think wouldn't wish hyperemesis on anybody ever. So many of the birth stories I've had on this podcast where people have experienced that, I just think you don't really know until you know, right? And it's not something that you you want to find out.
Absolutely. Yeah, would not recommend to a friend.
No, absolutely not. Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Sinead, for coming on the podcast today. I've really loved talking to you, and you've got such a different experience to what I've had on the podcast recently. I think there'll be people who take different things from your episode, and I just appreciate your honesty and your openness, and I'm very grateful that you were willing to spend time with me this morning. So thank you.
Oh, honestly, the honor and the privilege is all mine. I love sharing my story. I don't want this to scare anyone off having a baby, though. Don't worry, there's no way that all of these bad things that happened to me will happen to you.
Thanks so much for tuning into this week's episode of Kiwi Birth Tales. I hope you have enjoyed it. I am looking forward to bringing you another episode next week, so make sure that you tune in and turn your notifications on if you want to be the first to know when a new episode goes live. Wherever you're listening from in the world, I hope you have a beautiful day, a beautiful week, and I will talk to you soon.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.